Washington, Court of Appeals, Division 1, Executive Session, Honorable Ronald Cox presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. State versus Davis is the first case on the docket.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Mark Mestel. I was counsel below for Mr. Davis, who's present in court today, and I'm his appellate counsel. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve perhaps 3 minutes.
Three? Very well.
Your Honor, this is a prosecution arising out of Snohomish County in which Mr. Davis and Mr. Saunders were repossession agents, and they were hired to repossess two vehicles that had been purchased in the state of Texas, were now delinquent and have been removed from the state without permission of the lien holder, brought to Washington. Unbeknownst to the owners of the vehicle, the people who sold it to them had inserted GPS trackers in the cars so that they could be located for situations such as this. Mr. Saunders and Mr. Davis had been in business together. They were contacted. They were advised that these cars were now ripe for repossession, and they were directed to where the cars would be through the use of the GPS tracking device. They first drove Mr. Davis, Mr. Saunders, and Mr. Davis's son, Chet, who's an adult son, drove to Mount Vernon, where they encountered the car going through a Kentucky Fried Chicken drive-thru. Mr. Saunders got out of the car that had been driven by Mr. Davis and approached the Valdez vehicle. I believe that was the Explorer that was in line waiting to pick up food from the takeout, knocked on the windows, had the repossession papers in his hands, and asked them to pull over.
Mr. Mestel, I think we've got the facts.
Got the facts? Okay. So I want to focus on two main issues in the case. One is the initial aggressor instruction, and the other is the rebuttal evidence. And I want to try to explain how they're intertwined, not only concerning the lawful use of force, but also concerning the argument that was primarily raised in Mr. Saunders' brief, which has to do with the to-convict instruction for the kidnapping. My client was convicted of the four counts, two kidnap twos, two assault twos, all while armed with a firearm. His position was that after the Valdez vehicle attempted to flee from the Burger King, almost striking Mr. Saunders, they were going to acquire the second vehicle when they again saw the first vehicle and followed it into the Burger King parking lot. Mr. Davis testified that Mr. Valdez, upon seeing Mr. Saunders exit his vehicle, gunned his vehicle, and proceeded to drive toward his son, Chet. He reached into his car, retrieved an unloaded shotgun, pointed it at the Valdez vehicle, and had them come to a stop. The occupants of the Valdez vehicle were then forcibly removed and placed in separate vehicles. The issue is whether this is an appropriate fact situation for the giving of an initial aggressor instruction, which essentially undermines the defense of lawful use of force.
And the question is there any evidence that would support the giving of the instruction? Is there some disputed evidence about whether or not the defendants engaged in some contact that brought about the need for the use of self-defense?
Well, clearly, I don't believe there's any evidence in Mount Vernon that Mr. Saunders did anything which was an act likely to produce a belligerent response under the law.
From their version of the incident, but what about the version that was given by Mr. Valdez?
Mr. Valdez has some stranger coming up and telling him to pull over, but that's essentially all that there is. There's no weapons displayed. There's no threats. There's no use of force. Simply, I'm going to well, according to Valdez, he doesn't even know there's going to be a repossession. He's just waiting to get some fried chicken and to go on his way. But his reaction is pulling out of this drive-thru, hopping a curb, and almost running someone over. So,
Does that warrant an inference that perhaps whatever the conduct that Mr. Saunders engaged in, it was sufficient to frighten, in any event, Mr. Valdez?
That's an interpretation, Your Honor, and that's the interpretation Mr. Valdez wanted you to believe.
And is that not sufficient for the judge to give an instruction on initial aggressor?
I don't believe it is, Your Honor, because either there was a use of, well, in the first place, there was no crime committed there. All right, so you would have to then find that triggered an initial aggressor instruction for what happened some 30 minutes later in a different county, in a different location. We're not talking about an assault that occurred at the Kentucky Fried Chicken. We're talking about an assault that occurred at the Burger King. But regardless, either it was a lawful use of force or it wasn't an unlawful use of force. What if my client had been a process server going up to serve him lawfully with papers? He didn't want to be served with papers, so he did the same thing. Some strange guy coming up to him. I don't believe.
It seems to me that there's a disputed issue of whose facts do you believe? Do you believe Mr. Valdez's facts? Do you believe Mr. Saunders' facts? If you believe Mr. Valdez's facts, or at least if there's some reason for the jury to give some credit to them, then there's sufficient evidence for the judge to give the instruction.
With all respect, Judge, I don't agree.
Okay.
All right. If he came up to the car and he wasn't doing anything wrong, regardless of the reaction of the occupants of the car, why would my client be the initial aggressor?
Okay. Can you address the merger issue?
Yes, I can address the merger issue, Your Honor. Although I have to say that based on my preparation last night, it still appears that the statute still provides that if the court imposes, if the jury returns four firearm enhancements, that the law says the enhancements have to run consecutive to each other, which would give a total of 12 years. And as you're aware, the judge in this case found mitigating circumstances imposed no time other than the enhancements. In this case, clearly the judge found it was the same course of criminal conduct in his calculations. It's my contention that the assaults merged with the kidnap, that the only reason of pointing the gun at the vehicle or at the occupants of the vehicle was to get them out of the vehicle and then restrain them to take them to where the other car was.
State v. Taylor holds against you, does it not?
Yes, it does.
How do you explain the distinction there? And why should we ignore State v. Taylor?
Well, the only thing I can point out is that I just believe that it was wrongly decided, Your Honor, that this is a situation where in every robbery, too, where there's an assault as a component of it, the state can charge assault to and charge robbery to. If they get convictions on both with firearms, you're going to be looking at a mandatory 6 years enhancement, even though it's basically the same crime. And it strikes me, and I understand that the weight of authority may be against me, but it strikes me that you should not be allowed to stack enhancements for one crime, even though you're arguably not exceeding the statutory maximum, because the statutory maximum is 10 years on each crime. And even with 12 years, you're looking at a crime that could have been, I assume, 40 years.
Right. You have your rebuttal time.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. I'm Kathleen Weber. I represent the state of Washington. The two issues that have been discussed here this morning relate to the first aggressor instruction and then the question regarding sentencing and double jeopardy as it relates to the firearm enhancements.
I'd like you to direct your attention to the merger issue.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to, the state, I believe, has conceded in its briefing that if the court does find that the kidnapping and assaults merge, then the firearm enhancements merge. It's our position that the kidnapping and assault convictions do not merge for a couple of reasons. Number one, there are two ways to analyze merger or analyze the double jeopardy issue. One is under the Blockberger test, which the state has adopted, and one is under the merger test, which is a rule of statutory construction to determine whether or not one offense is merely incidental to the other offense. It has to do with how the statutes are written. It only applies in a circumstance where, in order to prove the degree of one offense, you also have to prove another offense occurred. In this case, as in Taylor, the court found, and it's still true, that you can commit a second-degree kidnapping without committing a second-degree assault, and you can commit a second-degree assault without committing a second-degree kidnapping. So merger doesn't...
But Taylor was decided before Freeman, and doesn't Freeman tell us that you don't just look at the elements in the abstract, you look at how the case, the charges were charged and proven? So you
right,
to
and
look
Freeman
at,
is under the block... Freeman is analyzed under the Blockberger test, which is a separate test to determine whether or not double jeopardy applies here. So under Blockberger, you look at two things. You look at whether or not they're the same in law, and you also look at whether or not they're the same in fact. So they're not the same in law, because for the same reason that they're that the merger test doesn't apply here is because you can commit an assault too without committing a kidnapping and vice versa. They're not the same in fact, because if you look at the testimony in this case, the assault discontinued once they bundled the victims, Mr. Valdez and his son JV, into the car and then started driving them off. The kidnapping actually started when they bundled them into the car and drove them off. Because that's where they to convict the defendants of kidnapping, you have to establish an abduction. That's a form of restraint plus use of force. So they restrained them by not just forcing them to stop the car or forcing them out of the car, but they abducted them by pulling them into the respective vehicles and driving off with them. So they're really not the same in fact.
But you charged them as using deadly force in order to accomplish that. Is that right? That's how you got the kidnapping too.
No, the kidnap. Well,
otherwise it would have been unlawful imprisonment.
Right, but the kidnapping occurred more if they had not taken them into the car, and if they had not driven off with them, they would at most have been guilty of unlawful imprisonment because they would have kept them in a single place. They would have been just restrained unlawfully in one place while the guns were pointed at them. But they discontinued pointing the guns at them once they put them in the car and drove them off. Under everybody's testimony, they put the guns away.
As it was charged.
Right.
Kidnapping in the second degree.
Mm-hmm.
Intentionally abducts, restrains.
Right.
Which means one prong is through the use of, or threatened use of force.
Right.
The state had to prove that in order to get a kidnapping and a second degree conviction. So you can't really separate them out like that. It seems to me that one is part and parcel the other.
When, in order to prove the defendant guilty of second degree kidnapping, we had to prove that he intentionally abducted another person under circumstances not amounting to kidnapping in the first degree. So in the two convict instruction, the jury was instructed that we had to show an intentional act and that an act was an abduction of another person. What I'm saying is that regardless of how they're charged, factually, they're two separate crimes. There are two separate crimes. You've got the assault that occurred when the guns were pointed at these two individuals. That stopped once...
Well, if that force is a separate issue and it's mm-hmm. stopped, then how do you get to kidnapping in the second degree? I mean, how do you prove kidnapping in the second degree? What deadly force is used after that to elevate this crime to kidnapping in the second degree?
Well, kidnapping second degree doesn't require deadly force. It just requires some kind of threat of force.
How was it charged?
Well, it was charged as a kidnapping second degree. Abduction... The definition of abduction is restraint plus force or threat of force. It doesn't necessarily require deadly force.
And that's how the jury was instructed.
Right.
And that's what the jury found, that this kidnapping was accomplished through the use of deadly force, right?
That it was accomplished through the use of force or threat of force.
Or
the threat of force
of deadly
continued
force.
After the threat of force continued after they were stuck in the or put in the car and driven off, because in two separate instances, once in Mount Vernon and once in Arlington, the defendants forcefully approached these individuals. And I disagree with the defense characterization of the evidence that all that happened in Mount Vernon was that the Mr. Saunders approached the victim vehicle. They, in fact, blocked the exit to the drive-through, and that forcing Mr. Valdez to escape by jumping a curb and driving over a grass median. So there's that threat of force that, hey, we're going to do something to you guys if you don't do what we tell you to do. Then they show up unexpectedly half an hour later in Arlington. The Valdezes thought this was all over, and here these guys show up again. And according to the testimony of four of the witnesses, the Valdezes did nothing before these guys get out of the car and start pointing guns at them. So the fact that they've showed an intent to use a firearm impliedly show some force even after the firearms are put away and after the assault is ended when they're in the car. I mean, these guys, the victims don't know what these guys are planning on doing. They only know that these guys have twice now approached them unexpectedly and in an aggressive manner, and that certainly JV's actions of going in the car and at their direction without even questioning it, certainly the jury could infer from that the reason why he did it is because he was afraid of future force. And then when Mr. Valdez says, well, can my son ride with me? And they said, no, he cannot ride with you. He has to ride in that other car. That's another sort of force that's separate and apart from the force that was used in the firearm when they used the firearm.
Do you recall what was argued to the jury by the state?
No, I don't recall the closing arguments at this point. I did not review them before this morning's argument. So, but even over and above what the state argued.
My recollection is that that's not the theory that the state argued at trial.
Well, but even over and above what the state argued to the jury, there is evidence that would support two separate and distinct crimes. And although the court found that they were same criminal conduct is a is an analysis for determining an offender score under statute. It has nothing to do with the double jeopardy analysis that we're talking about here today. In the remaining time that I have, I would just indicate to the court that it's the state's position that under the conflicting evidence, the first aggressor instruction was appropriate. The trial court did not abuse its discretion when it gave the first aggressor instruction because there was evidence that conflicted with the defendant's account of what happened, that both in Mount Vernon, in blocking the driveway and unexpectedly approaching the victim and banging on the door and then yelling at them, as they came around the corner of the drive-thru, and then again at the Burger King parking lot in Arlington, coming out without warning with at least one, if not two, firearms pointed at the victims, that the defendants did do aggressive acts, which if you believe the defendant's testimony that our victims tried to run one of the defendants over, would have provoked those acts. I mean, in Arlington, there's even conflicting evidence as to whether or not the victim did anything to justify the defendants bringing out their firearm and attempting to defend themselves or placing them under arrest. But if you believe that, then there certainly was evidence to justify the first aggressor instruction. So I'm asking the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Judge Spearman, I want to talk to you again about the initial aggressor instruction. Part of the kidnap in the second degree requires that there be a use of force to restrain the person. Now, I also remember that it was alleged as deadly use of force, and that's why the firearm became important in proving that. But the judge instructed the jury that my client's part of the component of lawful use of force was the right to make a citizen's arrest, and advised the jury that they could base that on a showing of probable cause, either for a second-degree assault by using the vehicle or an attempted vehicular assault. Do you believe that there should be initial aggressor instructions that prevent people from performing citizen arrests? So that if I go up and provoke somebody, let's say I bump into them and they pull out a gun and shoot my companion, are you saying that I can't then use force to arrest them because I bumped them? In the case of my client, if he went up to make a repossession which provoked a belligerent response and they had shot his son, would he not be allowed to use force to arrest them?
I assume that's a rhetorical question.
It is a rhetorical question because I understand that you're not here to answer my questions, Your Honor. But I believe that the answer is that in a citizen's arrest situation where the judge properly instructs the jury about the right to conduct a citizen's arrest, that there should never be a room for an initial aggressor instruction. And frankly, if State versus Riley suggests that this is the type of instruction which should be sparingly used, this is the type of case where either it was a lawful use of force or it wasn't a lawful use of force. Yes, there are stories on both sides, but one side is that the use of force was lawful. The other side is that there was no reason to use force. You were always the aggressors. By bringing in that rebuttal testimony, it showed the jury that perhaps my clients weren't acting in accordance with the standards of the industry, but it didn't show that they were acting unlawfully. And I believe that just by acting inappropriately does not give somebody the right to have a belligerent response and thereby deprive you of your defense of lawful use of force. Thank you.
Thank you. Next matter, State versus